first time that I'm teaching in a Mahayana center or monastery. And this might be the first time, I'm not sure, that you have a Theravadan teacher here. Is that correct? So we're having two firsts. And I think it is a very auspicious occasion. I met the Dalai Lama for the first time last year in February in Bodh Gaya at our nuns conference, and he said to me that for the past 25 years he's had a lot of dialogue with Christians, and didn't I think it was time that he had some dialogue with the Theravadas. I heartily agreed. So I think we are making our step in that direction. We're going to have dialogue between each other. And in the first instance, I'm going to use the words that we have taken from the Pali and Sanskrit in their Pali pronunciation, which is different slightly from what you're used to. I think you'll recognize them easily because you're pronouncing them in Sanskrit. Or probably, yes. But I'm trained to pronounce them in Pali, and I couldn't possibly at short notice change that. So if any of the words are unfamiliar, sound unfamiliar to you, they're not, but sound, you can always ask. But I always make it a habit to translate any of these foreign words also into English. So there should be little difficulty. What we do at the start of a course, when we are in surroundings that are conducive to that, that I praise the Buddha and dedicate myself once again to Buddha Dhamma Sangha in this teaching. So this is going to take just a moment, and I think you may understand the words, or even though they're Pali words. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami, dhammam saranam gacchami, sangham saranam gacchami. Dutayampi buddham saranam gacchami, dutayampi dhammam saranam gacchami, dutayampi sangham saranam gacchami, tatayampi buddham saranam gacchami, tatayampi dhammam saranam gacchami, tatayampi sangham saranam gacchami. I also have to ask your indulgence when I start coughing. I had pneumonia a few weeks ago and still not quite gone, so it's unfortunate, but it's part of dukkha that all of us are prone to and have. for those of us who want to meditate, there is very little doubt that we are looking for something that is other than what we're used to in the world. In other words, we are already wise enough to know that the world hasn't quite fulfilled our expectations. And maybe we're already wise enough to know that it never will fulfill our expectations. But that is a big step. In any case, if we sit down and try to meditate, then we are trying to transcend our ordinary consciousness. The ordinary consciousness with which we do all our ordinary business. The one that is used in the marketplace, where we go shopping, where we bring up children, where we do our work in our offices, in our businesses, where we clean houses, make bank statements, consolidate, and all the rest of it. That kind of consciousness is known to everyone, and without it, we can't possibly survive. And it's a survival consciousness. We need it for that. But it cannot possibly get far enough and deep enough into the experience of the Buddha's teachings, because the teachings are unique and profound, and the ordinary everyday consciousness is neither unique nor profound. It's just utilitarian. We need it, but that's all. And in order to gain the kind of consciousness that is capable of going deep enough into the teaching to make them one's own, and after having made them one's own, to change one's whole inner viewpoint, needs a mind that has the ability to remove itself from that ordinary consciousness. That's only possible through meditation. There's no other way. Meditation is therefore a means and not an end in itself. It is a means to change our mind capacity and ability in such a way that we can see entirely different realities from the ones we're used to. This knowledge that meditation is a tool is important, because it's often confused with an end in itself. It is the tool. In Pali it's called bhavana, mind training. It is the tool for getting the mind where the mind becomes such a honed, sharp, and clear tool that it sees far beyond this everyday reality. Most people that sit down to meditate are keen on getting some peace and quiet into their mind. And that's as good a reason to sit down to meditate as any other. In fact, it's a better reason than others. And one should get some peace and quiet into one's mind. And again, that's not the purpose of meditation, but it is an absolutely essential aspect of it. You're familiar with the words samatha and vipassana, even though you pronounce them differently. And samatha, the calm and vipassana, the insight. And these two are the only two directions there are in meditation. There are innumerable methods. The Buddha taught, according to the canon, 40 different methods. They're all listed, and we certainly do not need to use 40. Some of the 40 methods that are listed are methods that are strictly vipassana methods, insight methods. Some are strictly samatha, calm. But the purpose of meditation is insight. And the means is calm. So that what everybody is looking for, some calm, some peace, some lack of worry in the mind, some lack of rummaging around and going around in circles in the mind. That is the means. The means towards an end. And while it is necessary to cultivate those means, the calm, it is hardly possible for anyone, although there are laudable exceptions, to sit down and become calm. Unfortunately, our mind is used to being exactly the opposite. Our mind is used to thinking, evaluating, and judging. And it does that from morning to night. And then from night to morning, it dreams. So it doesn't get a moment's rest. Now, if we were to do that with our bodies, we would soon be out of commission. A body can't handle that for more than a few days, never having a moment's rest, working all the time. Whereas we are asking this of our mind, and then we're surprised why things don't work the way we thought they might, and we might even be surprised why the world doesn't work the way we thought it could. It would be surprising if it were otherwise, because what we see in our own mind is exactly what's going on in everybody else's. And that is a very important aspect of the meditative mind, to realize that we are not individually burdened with all this dukkha. It is a universal aspect of existence, which is the first noble truth. And most of you must have heard it more than once, and very few people remember it. Not the words. The words are easy enough to remember. But to apply it to whatever happens. Dukkha, unsatisfactoriness is universal. It doesn't belong to any one of us. We have no monopoly. What goes on in our own mind goes on in everybody else's. And this is why the world looks the way it does. And that's why meditation looks the way it does. So we have to train the mind to stop doing what it's used to be doing. It's used to think. And when we want to become calm, when we want to have some peace in the mind, it's got to stop thinking. Well, that's much easier said than done, because it will continue to do what it's used to do. But there's another reason why it continues to think, not just because it's used to thinking, because that's the only ego support we have while we're meditating, and particularly when we're silent. I think, therefore I am, one of our many philosophers put that out as a veritable truth. What he actually said was a relative truth, which is happening to all of us. When we're thinking, we know we're here. When there's nobody chattering in our mind, we think we lose control. It's exactly the opposite. As long as we can't stop thinking, we have no control. Only when we're able to stop thinking, when we want to, then we're in control. And the difficulty that arises for most meditators, if not all, is that it's very difficult to let go. To let go of that last bit of ego support that we have while we're sitting here. That last bit of ego support is our thinking. And to let go of that has to be a deliberate act. Knowing it and then deliberately letting go. When we do our daily business, we deliberately put our mind in the direction of what we want to do. If we want to work in the kitchen, we deliberately go there, we deliberately put our attention on whatever it is that needs to be done. If we have a business in an office, we deliberately put our mind on that which needs to be done. It's the same in meditation. We have to deliberately put our mind on what needs to be done. And there are quite a number of things that need to be done. So our first difficulty is that although we'd like to become peaceful and calm and have no thoughts, our own mind does not like to obey. And it doesn't like to obey because we then have no support for our existence, and also because our habit speaks against it. So instead of trying again and again to gain that calm, we can use whatever arises to gain some insight. A little bit of insight brings a little bit of calm. And a little bit of calm brings a little bit of insight. And since our calm has no other purpose than changing our ordinary, everyday consciousness to a consciousness that is able to understand and to use the teachings of the Buddha to change our ordinary being into a transcendental being. So the calm which doesn't arise is no great problem, because whatever does arise helps us to gain some insight into who we are. And this is what a meditation retreat is all about. It's an inward journey. An inward journey to give us a little more understanding of who we are. Nothing could be more interesting than to find out who we are. But it also has some aspects from which we'd like to run away at times. This is what a meditation retreat is all about. Here we can't run away, unless we start fantasizing and making up stories. And everybody's prone to do that. But when that happens, let's just realize that that's nothing but running away. To make it an inner journey, which is really helpful to us, we're going to observe noble silence. Noble silence means not to talk to each other, which in a place such as this, where some of you live and know each other very well, is more difficult than in other places. Take the difficulty as a challenge. That's all. The challenges that we get in life are, when we master them, our stepping stones. Here in the hall, there are always times when I say, please ask questions. Please do so. It is an opportunity to have the dialogue which we need in order to gain better understanding. Also, there are, in the afternoon, there are interviews, and I will always call the names of whose turn it is, so that's a time to talk. And naturally, if there's any particular need or anything that you have, you can always talk to
Trime.
To Trime, who is the manager. But please, don't use that for an occasion to start conversations about non-essential aspects. It's something that it should be used for if you need something or can't find whatever you're looking for. The noble silence is one of the most effective tools for an inner journey. It is something that we don't usually have unless we go on a retreat. Usually we have people around us with whom we communicate. And our communication is one of our means of escaping from our own dukkha. The word dukkha must be familiar, or? And even if the word isn't familiar, the feeling is. So, it is a means of escape. And we have innumerable means of escape, which I will talk about at another stage. But this is one means which we want to block. That communication to get away from our own dukkha. If we keep in mind, and it's important to keep in mind, that the very first noble truth that the Buddha expounded after his enlightenment was, when he actually expounded his enlightenment, was that dukkha is the feature of existence. The first noble truth is the noble truth of dukkha. It means that if we are experiencing it in ourselves, all we're doing is proving the Buddha's teaching correct. That's all. We don't have to start suffering. All we have to do is look at it and say, of course. That is existence. In a small measure, in a larger measure, there's always something. And the one thing that always is there, and that is in most cases the reason to come to meditation, is that niggling feeling of not being totally satisfied with whatever it is one has tried before. And then there are innumerable other things that come up that also provide dukkha. But if we remember the first noble truth that dukkha is, and then look at it and say, that's right, that's what the Buddha said, and he also propounded the second noble truth, namely the reason for dukkha. The reason for dukkha being that we are wanting something. Then we have a very excellent opportunity to look into ourselves and see, well, what is it that I want that I'm not getting? Or what is it that I'm getting that I don't want? These are the two reasons. It's actually one reason for having dukkha. Simple, isn't it? What could be simpler? There's only one way of dealing with it when it arises, and that's dropping the wanting of what one hasn't got, or the wanting to get rid of what one has and that one didn't want. And dukkha disappears. But only such things are possible to realize within oneself when one doesn't have this outward going that we have through our communication and that we have through our busy activities. And so it is a necessity to have times when we can really look inside of ourselves. Such a time is given here in a place which couldn't be more conducive to this. Even the landscape is a kind of landscape that lends itself to an inner journey, because it also depicts us. And that is something that we will talk about at another time. At this stage, I would like to particularly talk about on the how-to and also where we can go with how we're doing it. I know that all of you, because I've seen your pieces of paper, have meditated before, but nevertheless, I will explain to you our way, the Theravadin way, of using the method and how the method is supposed to bring the desired results. Now again, methods are nothing but methods. There'll never be anything else. So whatever method we're using, it only has validity when it brings a result. If a certain method doesn't bring a result for someone, it's best to change the method. In other words, there's nothing that we should hang on as far as the method is concerned, because we only have two directions, and that is calm and insight. And if we can't get calmed, we can't get insight, well, we probably need another method. And that's why there are so many methods. Because people do have different tendencies, different characters, and although our minds all have the same potential and the same capacity, we do need different approaches. There's no doubt about it that people's background and also the way they have used their mind in the past makes it easier for them in one method and harder in another. The method that works is the one that's correct. There's the potential we have and the ability we have is the same. A human mind has the seed of enlightenment within. If it didn't have that, Buddha would have wasted his time. Because he was teaching ordinary people like ourselves. So ordinary people have that seed of enlightenment within. And we all have the potential to become calm and to experience different states and different stages of consciousness through the meditation. We all have that potential. And everybody has also that inner yearning for it. The inner yearning is there for a peace and quiet which goes beyond that everyday experience which you all know much too well, and that yearning already shows us that although we may not have ever experienced anything like that, underneath it all we know there must be something like it. And most people try to find this in so many different ways where it can't be found, because it's not out there anywhere. It's within us. We've got it. We've got that peace and quiet, that inner harmony within. The only thing that covers it up and that prevents us from experiencing is our thinking. The thinking puts the defilements, puts the difficulties into the mind, and once we're able to let go, we can experience the underlying purity of our mind. And everybody has it, but the approach for everyone is slightly different. And therefore, we also need a little bit of imagination for ourselves to use the methods in a way which help us to get the desired result. Our first and foremost method in the meditation is using the breath. And we use the breath as our meditation subject in different ways. And each person should choose that way which they find most conducive to their way of mind activity. There are minds who like pictures, who tell their stories in pictures. There are minds who like words, they chatter away and tell stories in words. There are minds who like numbers. They like to have everything in neat little boxes, numbered. And there are minds who like to be very detailed, have very small detail attention. We have to know what kind of mind we have, or at least we can try it out in the meditation, and see which one of the different ways of using the breath is most conducive for us to become calm. Using the breath is the first foundation of mindfulness. The first foundation of mindfulness is body, kaya nupassana. The body is kaya. The mindfulness of the body extends, of course, to breath. Now, that using the breath for our meditation subject means that we're using the first foundation of mindfulness. That mindfulness should extend to everything we do outside the meditation hall. Naturally, we're going to fall down on that, but at least we should direct our attention towards that goal and purpose. It's very nice to sit here and try to become calm and watching the breath, but if we do not reinforce that with our mindfulness outside of the hall, it will not have the desired result. We cannot split our mind in two. We cannot have a mind for the meditation hall and a mind for outside of the meditation hall. We have one mind and we have to train the whole thing. And the training extends then to whatever we do, which means getting up, walking, opening the door, closing the door. When we work, our work period, any kind of work we do, being fully attentive to the bodily action. The first foundation of mindfulness is attention on bodily action. It extends to having a shower, going to the toilet, getting up in the morning, stepping out of the bed, taking off the clothes, putting on other clothes. All these are bodily actions. One of the most conducive bodily actions to mindfulness is eating. Especially in the eating procedure, there are so many physical actions that we can pay attention to that it is a very important aspect of teaching ourselves mindfulness. We can already see from this sentence that there's no teacher. You're teaching yourselves. There's only some landmarks and there are only some signposts. That's all. Everybody is their own best teacher. We, in our tradition, we don't have gurus. All we have are people who reinterpret the Buddha's words out of the Pali Canon and may be able to give a bit of advice. Mindfulness can only be done and taught to oneself by oneself. Nobody can say to you, oh, you're mindful, or you're not mindful. You know when you are. Mindful means that the mind and the body are in the same place. Washing dishes while washing dishes. A famous sentence by Thich Nhat Hanh, a Vietnamese meditation teacher. Washing dishes while washing dishes. Not thinking, oh, I wish I was finished. Not thinking, I wish they weren't using so many dishes. I'm glad I don't have to do this tomorrow. Why do I always wind up washing dishes? Nothing like that. Just washing dishes. That's all. Same with eating. Not, oh, I like this. I wonder how they made it. Nothing like that. But just eating. The same with all other physical actions. The Buddha's words about mindfulness are, the one way for the purification of beings, for the elimination of pain, grief, and lamentation, for the final ending of all dukkha, for the entering of the noble path, for attaining of nibbana, is mindfulness. What more do we want? We've all got it. All we have to do is cultivate it. Meditation is the means to cultivate the mindfulness to the point where the insight becomes so strong that we can see absolute reality behind the relative reality in which we live. And this mindfulness that's being trained in the meditation is something that, especially in a retreat such as this, can then carry on in every activity. Now, I'm only going to talk about this physical one at the moment because it's the most apparent one. It's the one that we can really make use of. The body can be touched and the body can be seen. So with that, with the touching and the seeing of the body, of our own body, we have this chance of really having mind and body in the same place, instead of having the mind run off into its usual ramifications and the body doing something else. If we were to keep mind and body in one place, we would have no problem watching the breath. Because that's all that's happening. We're breathing. Nothing else. Everything else is conjecture. And so when we watch our breath, and I will give the five different ways of doing that in a moment, the mind being with the breath is actually mindful. And this is what this is called in Pali. It's called anapanasati. Sati is mindfulness. Ana is in-breath, pana is out-breath. It's called mindfulness of in-breath, out-breath. That's its traditional name. And so this is mindfulness of breathing that we can train ourselves in. We will notice again and again that the mind just does not wish to stay there. It wants to do something else. So we'll use that as insight into ourselves. And we don't just say, thinking, 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 because we know already that we're thinking. That's an old, old story. We're going to give it labels. We're going to say, past, future, nonsense. That fits almost always. We can say wanting, hoping, planning. That's a very popular one, planning. If you can't get anything done while you're sitting here, at least you can plan what you're going to do next week. That's popular. Any label that comes to mind. Now, not trying to find the exact right label, because that induces new thinking. But the first label that comes to mind, which is useful when the thing, when one gets involved in the thinking. Now, if the thoughts are like clouds in the background, do not have a very solid body to them, and keep disappearing, not necessary to run after them to give them a label. More experienced meditators, they are like clouds. Also has a name. You want to know these names? Upachari Samadhi, neighborhood concentration. But in that case, no need to find the label. But when the thinking is very solid, when the really the thinking is happening, then the label has two results. The first one is giving a label dissolves the thought, because you can't do two things. Giving a label means one is standing objectively in front of the thought, and in that moment the thought is dissolved. And the second result, a very useful result, is that one gains some insight into one's own thinking process. And that is extremely important, because no meditator who has meditated for some time will fall into the error to always believe his or her own thinking. Only people who never meditate believe what they're thinking. Because when one has labeled those thoughts, one has realized that this thinking process that's happening there is arbitrary. It has no real meaning. It is very often, as I said, nonsense, no sense to it. And it isn't even worth it. And the same thing happens in our everyday life. So gaining that insight into our thinking during the meditation helps us in everyday life to drop those thoughts which are not useful. And that makes life already at least 80% easier. The other 20% we have to work on something else. So if we can drop the thought by labeling it, which is an automatic process, and gaining an insight, we can do the same in our daily life. And if we don't, we've meditated in vain. We've been sitting here and getting a knee pain without any result. We've got to be able to transfer that what's happening in our meditation practice into everyday life. Which means, in the meditation, we drop all thoughts. They come again, but we drop them. And we substitute with the breath, with our attention on the breath. In daily life, we drop the unwholesome ones and substitute with wholesome ones. It's exactly the same process, the substitution. And having learned it in the meditation, it makes it so much easier in daily life. Not that it will always work. There's no such thing as always. It is always an understanding that there are possibilities. We can do it. And when we listen to the words of the Buddha, we will have to know that he is showing us an ideal that we can work towards, and that there's no blame involved, that we haven't reached that ideal yet. This is also important in the meditation, that we have the awareness of what's happening, but no blame. Awareness, no blame, change. It's an important formula to remember. To become aware of what's going on within oneself. But there's no blame to it. Things are the way they are. They just are. But we, as thinking human beings, have the ability to change. And that's what we're doing in the meditation. We can drop the thought and go back to the breath. And the more often we do it, the easier it becomes, naturally. It's a habit. The mind does eventually give up and say, well, all right then, I'll stop all this for a while. And not only does it become easier because of the habit, but because there will be more and more a determination because it becomes more and more apparent how unnecessary and how little useful the thinking is. How it brings absolutely no results, it goes around in circles, it's nothing but disturbing, so the mind gets a little more determined to stay with the meditation subject. If we can use this mindfulness of the breath in a way that is useful for us here in the meditation, then we have a very good handle on mindfulness in everyday life, in our everyday action. Our everyday actions have to support the meditation, and our meditation has to support the everyday action. It's impossible to make two out of us. There's one mind that we're training, and that is our great help, that our everyday action of mindfulness can be so useful for our meditation, because obviously our daily activities far surpass in time, usually, the time we spend in meditation. So we can't just drop the whole thing when we get out of the meditation. And in the retreat, we have a particularly good opportunity for that. The ways of using the breath. The traditional, the most difficult, but also the most conducive to calm, is to watch the breath at the nostrils, as the breath goes in and out. Now in our tradition, we watch both, in and out breath. The reason for that is that we do not wish to give the mind more chances than necessary to wander off into its usual way of thinking unnecessary thoughts. So we want it to stay with the breath, whether in or out. The breath is wind, and with the wind of the breath, there is a feeling when the wind of the breath touches the nostrils. There's a feeling. That feeling helps one to focus at that point. Now this is the most one-pointed way of doing it, but of course also the most difficult, and it is particularly useful for experienced meditators. If one is an experienced meditator, that is good. Because it is one-pointed, the mind becomes one-pointed. One-pointed in Pali is ekagata. Eka means one. And that is one of the five factors which is needed for the first meditative absorption. I will explain those meditative absorptions in detail, but not now. So one-pointedness means being in one spot. So it is a very important aspect, but it's also difficult. This particular thing is difficult because there's no other support for it. So we use other supports. One of them, traditionally, is counting. What we do is we say one on the in-breath, one on the out-breath, two on the in-breath, two on the out-breath, no further than 10. Every time the mind wanders off, back to one. It's no use trying to figure out whether it was 4 or 5 or 8 or 9 or must have been 10 at least, but just back to 1, whatever it is. Now this is useful for, as I said before, people who like numbers. People who like to have things in orderly little boxes. For them, this is a good way. Some people are not very fond of numbers. A word is good. For instance, the word peace. Peace on the in-breath, peace on the out-breath. Any word will do. Words are just words. They only become something if they mean something. So whatever word means something, you can, for instance, use the word peace on the in-breath, love on the out-breath, which means you're filling yourself with peace and you're extending love outward, peace and love. However, it is more useful to use just one word. The more input into the mind, the less it becomes calm. So if you can use one word, peace on the in-breath, filling yourself with it, and peace on the out-breath, extending it outward, That's good. That's very useful. Now that's for people to whom words are important. That's a good thing to do. If one doesn't like either numbers or words, and not that, then pictures. Using the breath as if, or experiencing the breath as if it was a cloud. Filling oneself with that cloud that comes in. Seeing the breath actually as a cloud. People who are very visual see things. They don't talk about it in their mind so much, they see it. They usually have a silent movie going. The others have a movie going with the words. The breath is as if it were a cloud that comes in, fills one, and then comes out again. Now in the out-breath, for those that would like to use that as a cloud going out, one can, for instance, experience it as if this cloud goes out and envelops one. Whatever the mind can do. And then it comes back in. Some people make the cloud have different shape, because when it is outside, it's bigger than when it goes in through the nostrils, becomes smaller. Anything is better than discursive thinking. Using this cloud affair is, of course, not as one-pointed as just being here, but it's 100 times better than discursive thinking about what happened last week and what's going to happen next week, or what happened this morning, what's going to happen tomorrow morning. So these are 4 different ways. And then there's one other way that can be used, which is also very helpful to people who have not had an enormous lot of practice. Following the breath in and watching it wherever it becomes apparent, which means goes in through the nostrils, goes up the nose, one can feel it in the throat, one can feel it in the lungs, one can feel it as far as the stomach is concerned, as far down as here. Then one can feel it going out again. Now, not searching for it, but putting one's attention on all the spots where it becomes apparent, in and out. Now, these are 5 different ways. One at a time, please. One should pick the one that one feels this will be comfortable for me to do, and use it during the whole session, that particular sitting. Then, if it was absolutely useless, try another one. But use it during the whole sitting. And not change while this one sitting is going on. The sittings are all going to be 45 minutes. So, one pointed at the nostrils, numbers, words, picture, or becoming aware of it wherever the actual breath can be felt. Now the last one also can turn into, and very often does, filling oneself with the breath and then getting rid of all the breath again. Now this is also useful because it keeps the mind a little more in place than just watching it coming in and out here. This is the most difficult. If one fills oneself with the breath, there may be a feeling with that. Well, there definitely is a feeling with it, but one may be aware of that, which again helps one to stay with it. If possible, to direct the mind a little more than just letting it run off, it is useful to direct the mind towards the impermanence of the breath. Now, obviously, the mind wants to think. The untrained mind wants to think. The mind that has not gone into what we call the meditative absorptions wants to think. There's just no two ways about it. But we can give it something useful to think about. It doesn't have to think about just whatever comes up. So in that case, if the mind really doesn't want to stay with the experience of the breath, keeps on thinking, if that is the case, then give it that something useful to think about, namely the impermanence of this breath. How? The in-breath is finished. The out-breath is finished. Constant change. And how our life depends on this constant change. How there's no way we could stay alive without this breath changing all the time. If we were to keep it in, we'd be dead in a few minutes. If we were to keep it out, we'd be dead in a few minutes. We can only be alive because it goes in and out. It changes all the time. And this is an important aspect which will give the mind maybe a little more connection to the impermanent aspect of each person, of ourselves. If the mind likes to stay on the breath and has a certain ability already to stay on the breath, let it be there. But if it is a constant thought process, one thought after another, direct the thinking towards the impermanence. Because the impermanence of the breath immediately gives rise to the understanding that, well, if my life depends on that, what can I find that isn't like that within me? And then the mind might go inside, and then it might be able to stay on the breath a little easier. A little bit of insight brings a little bit of calm. A little bit of calm brings a little bit of insight. Everybody likes to have some calm naturally, and they should have it too. They have to have it after death. No way we can go into death. But we need a little bit of insight, especially the Westerner. We've been trained from kindergarten on to investigate, to find out, and to think about it. And so we're still doing so. And it's difficult for such a mind to stop doing that on just on demand. So we have to give it all the possibilities. So there we have a thought process of impermanence which is useful and brings insight rather than a useless thought process about past or future. Staying with the breath means that we are actually in the moment. And that's what mindfulness is, to be in the moment. And this is, as absurd as it may seem, what we hardly ever do. We can only live life each moment, and yet our mind is concerned with the past, which is irrevocably gone, and with the future, which is nothing but a hope and a prayer. Because when the future really arises, it is always called the present. We can never experience the future. It's nothing but a concept. And if we want to live, we have to experience life. And the only way we'll ever experience it is to be in this moment. And the more we train the mind to be in this moment, the more we can actually know what living means. Otherwise, we're always either remembering or hoping. And this is where the labeling helps us. To be present now means to be in this breath. We cannot watch a breath that is past, and we cannot watch a breath that is in the future. We can only watch this one. There's only this one breath to be watched. So this is also a very useful way of realizing how our mind works. And the Buddha didn't want anyone to believe anything. He just wanted people to have enough confidence to try out. So whatever I've been telling you are nothing but directions, guidelines, signposts for you to try out for yourself.